This is a Gist of Freedom production at the CNN screening in D.C.
Matt, in terms of introductions, as we did in the audience with the members of the panel, I'm going to start to my left, and I'm going to ask that you state your name and your area of expertise, as you want to describe here for this particular forum, for the members in the audience. Alelia Bundles.
I'm delighted to be here. My name is Alelia Bundles, and I'm very interested in entrepreneurship. I come from a family of entrepreneurs. My great-great-grandmother was Madam C.J. Walker, who started was one of the pioneers of the modern hair care industry. And as a result of writing about her and doing a lot of research about her, I now have the privilege of interacting with a lot of entrepreneurs. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. My career, really, though, was as a journalist, and I was a producer and an executive of NBC News and ABC News for 30 years. So I look at things like this documentary, and I see it from a producer's perspective and from a story perspective. I'm also president of the Foundation for the National Archives and president of Madam Walker Family Archives. I have lots of pets, and I'm a big social media fan.
Nice. And Mr. Navarro Wright.
Sure. Navarro Wright, Chief Technology Officer, Interactive One, the online division of Radio and TV One. I'm responsible for all the internet technology for the company. Currently, that includes 65 radio sites across the country and 60 markets, 4 independent content verticals, Hello Beautiful, The Urban Daily, Elevate, and News One. Hello Beautiful actually just recently surpassed Essence as the largest women's African-American site online. And we also own the product Black Planet, which was one of the original social networks, and we are actually launching a new version of Black Planet that I designed February 2000 this year.
You know, you gave a good introduction when everyone's going, ooh, ah. That's Patricia Sluby.
I'm Pat Sluby, and I am a former U.S. tax examiner, now a registered agent, and I have written several books on African-American inventors. Out of part of my regular job as a traffic examiner with extra activity, so I have been researching a lot of minority inventors, women inventors, and what have you. So I decided to highlight the information about African-American inventors. So the last that I published in March of 11 last year, and series of African-American inventors, outpost of the invented spirit of African-Americans, because this is enterprises that are an outpost of
African-Americans. Last but not least, Ms. Joyce Johnson.
Thank you. My name is Joyce Johnson, and when Roy Paul asked me to participate, he wanted to describe me as a political person, which I am. But in seeing the documentary, there is a history behind my political view. I ran for Congress in 2010 and hope to do it again in 2012 in New York. In a prior life, 25 years ago, I was director of Equal Employment Opportunity for Ingram. So much of the and we were the first waves of blacks in corporate America. It was my job to make sure that those opportunities were. Much of what I saw in the film today, it was a throwback of that time as well. And there was a certainly white structure in terms of corporate America, not used to blacks coming in, and some of the barriers, some of the question marks. So the first wave had to be so perfect. Even there was something called cosmetically correct. We had to be cosmetically correct, have good backgrounds and all of that, and it was almost like deja vu all over again. But the industries now are different, and so we're talking about technology. But some of the job drama, some of the challenges are still the same. Because when all is said and done, why someone is chosen, oftentimes it has to have as much to do with comfort, who they've seen and how they've interfaced. And so to the extent that I think that these forerunners pipeline gets bigger, when their performance becomes better and better, becomes no place and color is not an issue, and they will get those calls for technology, whatever. So it is a great pipeline. So I'm really thrilled to be here to share some of that. But this was really a throwback of my own experience coming up in corporate America, probably yours as well, isn't it? NBC and ABC.
Thank you. We're going to start off with Mr. Navarro, right? And I know that due to time, you have to catch train or a bus out. And so we're going to
We're good for a little while,
but we're going to start off with you, and we know that you're going to leave early at some point. Talk about post this documentary. I'm sort of curious to find out what happened since that aired and how everyone's doing.
Sure. I think, you know, in the scheme of this program, is they're called accelerators. The other term is used incubators, and there's a few in Silicon Valley that are pretty prevalent in mainstream. And this one, in terms of the scorecard, as one of the guys mentioned, did fairly well. I mean, you saw that B-Coupley received funding. You saw that CloudCo received funding. Anthony Frazier from Newark did launch his app in the App Store. It's in the App Store right now. Tiffany Ashley Bell, who had the company Pencil UN, actually, you know, she did what's called in the entrepreneurial terms a pivot, which I actually helped her with. And now her hair care app is a mobile app. It's actually in the iPhone store as well. Angela Benton did move to Silicon Valley with her children, as you saw. And she actually landed Google as her title sponsor for the second class of the Dumi Accelerator, which starts in February. So everyone has moved forward in their process. I think, you know, entrepreneurship is hard, and the data in the beginning was accurate that about 80% of people who try to become an entrepreneur technology fail. So given those parameters and given the number of people involved in this program, it was a pretty high rate of success given the first time. And there actually were three entrepreneurs who were local entrepreneurs who were in the program that weren't covered by the documentary, and actually all three of them received funding, and two of them were accepted into another of the leading accelerator programs a month later. So I think it did prove that when we, you know, which we already know through history, that once we have the right environment and the right exposure, that we can go in and create change.
Is there going to be a sequel or a part two to this documentary?
Unfortunately, you know, the way the CNN Black in America documentaries work is they pick a subject and they cover it once, and they move on to the next subject. There will be another Black in America, but it'll be on a different topic. Remiss in kind of giving CNN credit. This is the fourth in their series. I think we all have watched it and all have cheered and criticized them at the exact same time. But the reality is, you know, they have shifted from covering multiple topics, which people complained about, to covering single topics, which people complain about because they feel like they don't cover them enough. The challenge is, you know, just being involved in this process, it's really hard to capture 9 weeks of activity in roughly 40 minutes of TV time. So the young lady here mentioned, yes, there was a lot of things on the cutting room floor, but I do think they did a good job of kind of showing the progression and giving you kind of sticking your toe in the water in terms of understanding some of the challenges. So I do give them credit for that.
Given your background, I was amazed at all the stuff that you've done. You certainly sort of took your neck out there knowing that the vast majority of people who enter the entrepreneurship world are not successful. How did you get involved? Why did you get involved? And what were some of the challenges along the way?
I mean, I think for me, you know, I've been involved in technology for about 20 years now, and I've always been the lone Black guy, so that's not, you know, anything new to me. I would say I was, you know, I've been involved in technology before technology was cool and sexy, right? When no one wanted to hear what I did for a living, when I told them I was in IT, free the internet world, and I watched it change around me and become part of our everyday lives. But the unique thing in that is that we, you know, we're not non-existent in the field, but we're nowhere near as existent as we need to be. And for me, being involved in this process and actually, you know, one of the things that I've done, I actually started an internet company with Russell Simmons called GlobalGrind.com and actually went to Silicon Valley and raised about $4.5 million. So I have firsthand experience of some of the challenges that these guys are going to face, but also firsthand experience in understanding what people needed to do to be prepared. I mean, you know, that dinner you saw 5 minutes, which was probably an hour and a half conversation of that nature, because there is a certain way to do it, and we have to take advantage of the limited opportunities that are put in front of us and see them as a blessing. I think if you get an opportunity and you waste it away, it's almost worse than never getting the opportunity. And those guys, you know, sometimes it's you get so happy with getting something, you don't recognize that you have to keep the same level of focus throughout the process. And what I didn't want to have to happen is that those guys were so happy that they were in this program and they were going to be on CNN. And what I told them is that, you know, the CNN thing lasts 5 minutes, right? It, you know, the company is supposed to last a long time, and there's economic opportunities here. So that's kind of what I stressed to them throughout that process.
Ms. Bundles, you said that you wore several hats. I want you to talk about those hats in relation to the documentary, especially your hat as a journalist and looking at this as a story, because it is a story from beginning to end.
Well, you know, I watched it when it first aired, and I thought there was good character development. We got to know the people. But there were also things, it played on your emotions with the racism that was there, and you knew that that was part of the obstacle. But you also knew that ultimately that didn't matter because they were there to be successful with their businesses. And there were a lot of things that I learned. One of the pattern matching was one of the notions that was there, which is, you know, basically the people who are getting the venture capital are the guys, the white, young white guys who went to Stanford and Harvard. And they tend to get funded first. And I happen to have had, during the last 48 hours, a really amazing set of free experiences with African-American women entrepreneurs. I was in New York for a small dinner with the two sisters who founded Mr. T.T. and Miko Branch. They have been extremely successful. They're now in Target. Target hosted a dinner for them at the former Sumbly House, which is quite elegant. And to see how they, what they're doing on the web. Then this morning I was in Wilmington, Delaware at the 2012 jewelry launch, Tracy Lynn Jewelry. Now, most of you have not heard of Tracy Lynn. She's a fabulous motivational speaker. She now has 8,000 sales agents selling jewelry all over the country, and the company is 5 years old. But particularly relevant to this evening's conversation is lunch that I had with a woman named Ella Borglum, who started iella.com. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but I have her card to know about her. So Ella Gorgla has started a website, iella.com, that she describes to me as a cross between eBay and Gilt. Gilt, G-I-L-T, Gilt.com is the website where the company buys big lots of luxury items and sells them. On iella.com, it's share your closet. So she can swap, sell, and buy luxury items. You can get a Chanel bag that was $2,500 and those kinds of things. But she's an engineer, a sister who's an engineer, who has an MBA from Columbia and the London School of Business, who got $600,000 for startup money from the company that's been online just since April, that now has 55,000 followers and members. But she's having trouble raising the money to the next level, even though she was listed in Time magazine as one of the 10 New York startup squads, along with Sheryl Sandberg, and even though Inc. magazine was listed as one of 11 squads in 2011. So it's getting to that next level and getting that next level of funding if you are not a young white guy who went to Harvard and Stanford. So I've been learning a lot from watching this and from listening to her.
Now, I've interviewed you before about your great grandmother, Mother Mm-hmm. Walker. And you talked about her entrepreneurial successes. Talk about that period of time and today.
Well, 100 years ago, when Madam C.J. was in her house, when she founded her company, there was no Facebook, there was no Twitter, there was no Internet, there was no TV. There were no airplanes. So there were a lot of advantages that we have now. But through some of the things that still exist, which is the basic networking, the people skills that Anthony was mentioning, the networking, the dealing with other people, convincing people, having confidence in what you are doing and what you have to sell and having a great product, those things are still, she was able to develop a line of hair care products. That were the firm, but she helped to create an industry that's now a multi-billion-dollar industry with several tens of thousands of skills.
Ms. Luby, talk about the work that you do and the outlook on this issue from your perspective.
Okay. The work that I do in terms of highlighting the stories of African American Indians and doing the piece work, the documentation on them, it's been quite rewarding. There are thousands of African Americans been to, and thousands and thousands of those who have received U.S. tax grants. And covering this information is really, really phenomenal. They have done enormous work in all the areas of endeavor in the world. And these inventors started, the African Americans started the patents in 1921. And this is when slavery, but you have to get the border to the U.S. So when we move up into the 21st century, we have seen quite an accelerated of involvement with the patents and African Americans who have received U.S. In the work with, that I just did on entrepreneurial spirit of African Americans, that was rewarding. There's a lot of them on it. It was hard. It was very hard. It's difficult to find the capital, to find the money. But they persevered. Some of their stories become sad and tragic, and other ones are so it's been quite rewarding.
I hear over and over again, it's difficult to find this, it's difficult to find that, it's difficult to know where the money is, how to get a patent. Why isn't this information accessible? And it's not just for African Americans, it's for everyone.
Well, yeah, I mean, I challenge that a little bit. I think the challenge is that the information is accessible. People just aren't knowledgeable about where to look, right? You when you think about, you know, there's this term, the digital divide, right? And it's kind of, I believe it's kind of evolved over the last 10 years. You know, when you first heard the digital divide, it was that people of color did not have access to the Internet, right? It's evolved now that we have access in a lot more places than we did before, except for rural areas or areas that are way out there, right? We also over-index in uses of cell phone devices as our main Internet tool. The challenge is the digital literacy problem, right, is that we use these things, the text, things of that nature, but a lot of us don't know the value proposition in terms of how we can use them to change our lives. People don't know that there are classes from top universities in the country for free on iTunes that you can watch and teach yourself. People don't know that there's healthcare information readily available. People don't know that pretty much any question you have is a Google search away from answering, right? And it's that kind of empowerment that will allow people to become the next generation of entrepreneurs. I think, you know, part of the challenge is when people think of technology and entrepreneurship, they believe that if they weren't a computer science major, an engineering major, there's not an opportunity for them. I think we need to split that up. You know, there's straight technology entrepreneurship where someone's creating a product using technology, but then there is technology entrepreneurship enablement where you have a brick-and-mortar business or you have a moving business that you use technology to allow yourselves to grow and scale. Here's a great example of that. There's a device. It's called Square. And basically what it does is it allows you, it's a little device that plugs into the top of your iPhone or your Android phone and allows you to take credit cards for your business. Right. So no merchant account, no anything. You get the device. If you sign up online, they'll send you the device for free, or you can go into the Apple Store and buy it for $10, right? And if you think about the amount of African-American businesses that are cash only because they just can't qualify for an merchant account, that single device changes the game for small businesses. But that's just one example of products that exist today that if you want to ask 20 people in your neighborhood, they don't know anything about it. So we have to figure out a way to increase that awareness across our demographic groups and empower them. I mean, the reason I'm excited about this documentary is because hopefully it will start to click in people's minds to start discovering and thinking about these opportunities as realistic. Here's a second example I'll give you. I write blogs for the Huffington Post and various different other online publications. And one of the topics I wanted to touch on was the iPhone and, you know, the proliferation of apps and how people are becoming millionaires creating apps. So I said, you know what, I'm going to do research and see what it takes to build an iPhone app. So, you know, I went online. I found that on iTunes, the same class they teach at Stanford University, you can download for free. I went to the library, found 10 books on iPhone development. They're there in the library, readily available. Then I went to Apple. So what does it cost for me to become a developer and get my app in the App Store? It was $99, right? So you compare that to starting a laundromat, starting a restaurant, starting any of the brick-and-mortar businesses that a lot of us start. There's no reason why we don't bridge those gaps. And then the second thing I'll tell you is that there are kids 13, 14, 15 years old in suburbs who have built iPhone apps for fun, who are making $60,000 a year off their app, right? And the economic parity issue is huge here, because think about if that was a kid in inner city Chicago, not only is he changing the economic situation for him, he's changing the economic situation for their family. If Anthony goes back to Newark and he raises, let's say he raises $1 million and he's able to hire five or six people in Newark in his company, he's changed the economic parity situation for five people.
Right.
I mean, that's the economic and the exponential scale in which this can occur. The challenge is that we have what I believe is called a perception problem, right, in our inner cities, that we as African Americans believe that it's easier to become an entertainer, an athlete, than it is to become an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And why is that? The reason is that those are the examples that we see. You know, one of the things I told those guys in that dinner, I said, we're anomalous. I said that we're African Americans and that we understand this infrastructure enough to get here, create companies, and take advantage of that situation. We are anomalies within the minority sphere. We have to change that. And that's when you're going to really see, because I'm sure in this book, there's 100 examples. We have entrepreneurship in our blood. You know, I knew a guy who could take a piece of metal and scratch it a certain way in the ground and make phone calls. I knew a guy who could open up, didn't have an engineering degree, could open up a cable box and twist wires, and we watch free cable. Entrepreneurship is in our blood. You got, there's somebody in your neighborhood that without any training sat down and figured something out and just made it work, right? We just get to map those core principles to a path. Anywhere where we've done it, we've had economic parity and change. Now, the opportunity and the challenge is that technology is moving at an exponential rate. And if we don't get involved, if we don't make it an everyday part of our lives, we will be second-class citizens yet again. And the reality is there's simple things. Great example, I read a story that there was a Walmart in the town, and that the Walmart only accepted online applications online. So people were catching the bus, going in half an hour there to go fill an application just to be told that you go fill it out online.
Right?
Those are real barriers that exist today, and that technology is the only thing that's going to bridge those gaps. So we have to start building this awareness that it's not to demystify the whole thing about technology. It's just another way and an avenue for us to gain information. And the beauty is, the barrier is low. There's no one stopping you from utilizing technology today. And once we do that, we'll change the game. You'll have to write a whole other book.
Well, don't stay along that. We have inventors who are literate. They are migrant workers from all backgrounds, children and what have you, that are intuitive and they perceive the question and the answer.
You know, and I want to say, you know, what's important is what the value of community and its opportunity to make the next generation. If they're entrepreneurial, so much of our stuff, this is in politics as well, language that you say, you know, what the expectations are. You know, my dad was an electrical engineer, my mom was pre-med chemist. Every day of my life, my dad, you know, whatever you're going to do is math and science, math and science. It was so drilled in our heads, and we've got to get to the same point of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, where it becomes the drumbeat. And so that's the norm rather than I want to go out and do a hip-hop or do whatever. Those kinds of things are the value of community, and I think we need to do more of that, our voices.
Mr. Wright, when you were talking about...
My father's not here.
Navarro. When you were talking, I was going through my head, growing up of the people who I knew who got us the cable and did all that stuff. If I ever had to testify, I would never divulge anyone's name. Ms. Johnson, government responsibility, individual responsibility. You saw on the tape, one man said, you know, the government's not helping me do X, Y, or Z. It's not helping me with my entrepreneurship. Should the government play a role when it comes to an individual's entrepreneurial pursuit?
Collectively, the economy. It's all about the wealth and wellness of the country. You know, we were manufacturing, and now that's no longer. Everything is across the sea. We must necessarily, because it drives our capitalist our system. People who are working, doing stuff. I am thrilled that, you know, as the generations have changed now from when my generation went to corporate America, my daughter told me she wanted to do her own business, and I thought she was crazy. Only to find out she was just absolutely on the wave of all that inner whatever, to do their own thing, have their own businesses, be the master of their fate, and yes, that is. The entrepreneurial economy is our economy, and government does have a responsibility, the Small Business Administration. Some of the things and the barriers you talked about, where folks don't know some of the mechanics. We all know now to do Google. Google. You can Google everything. But I have heard in Harlem, the Upper West Side, in New York, where I live, so many business owners saying, we go downtown, but they're not helpful. Not helpful to my business in a way that it can thrive. So, yes, we do have a responsibility. Why? Because it's vested in our growing this great thing called capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, technology can't move at this. I mean, the government cannot move at the speed of innovation. They just cannot, right? There's two programs now. There's one called the National Broadband Plan that the FCC put in place to say that they want 90% of America to be connected to the internet. Okay, they put it in place. Now what, right? The challenge is that, you know, private businesses drive the innovation of technology because it drives their bottom line, and there's nothing wrong with that as long as we take advantage of that and we use that to our advantage and to our opportunity. If we wait for the government to create these inroads, we will still be left behind, because every day we're sitting here waiting for the government to do it, mainstream America is moving further and further ahead in this technology race, and more things that we use that are commonplace are becoming technology-enabled, and our people just don't have the skills to navigate. And so it's just that real. Like, we have, any time in our history, whether it was from black hair care to technology, right, when we needed it, we did it ourselves, right? And the challenge is that technology is unique, is that we have, there's a whole thing of being a consumer versus a creator. We believe it's okay to consume technology, but no one in our mind thinks about creating technology. I speak to youth groups a lot, and I'll ask them, I say, hey, there was a guy in a college eating a free meal plan, using a free software, and in 5 years now he's working with Puffy, Jay-Z, and Russell put together. Half the room doesn't know who I'm talking about. And I say, who in this room has a Facebook account? And they all raise their hand, right? That is the paradigm shift, that you can use Facebook, but you don't say, hey, can I build an app on Facebook? You beg your family to buy you an iPhone, but you never think about, well, what does it take to build an app on the iPhone? Until we make that shift, we're going to be left behind. Because I can tell you, in suburban America, they are asking that question, and they're doing it, right? They're doing it. And when you talk about demystifying education, you know, this is the one area where you don't necessarily have to go to college. And I encourage people to go to college. That's not a dissuasion. But the reality is that if you're in an economic situation, you want to better yourself, schools are there right now. Half these guys in Silicon Valley never went to college. They learned the skills at home using the internet, and now they've created something, and it's viable. So we have to get that teaching. And I think, you know, to finish off, it's not the government. It's civic organizations. It's the church. It's where we gather. And being in those places and having this dialogue, right, that as a community, how do we better ourselves? You know, I mean, you know, not to be rude, being mediocre is a sin. It's in the Bible. So, you know, in order for us to be adhering to the Bible, we have to focus on not being mediocre and living to our fullest blessings, and we're not doing that right now in this space. We're just not.
Being mediocre is a sin. It's in the Bible.
That's right.
You wanted to add
something? Well, yeah, so many things. But, you know, yes, people have to have their game together. That, for me, was one of the key lessons that you were giving. These extremely talented people, but really had to step up their game in order to compete. And that's sometimes people say to me, oh, I've got this great idea. You know, I want to start a business. And I'm like, have you gone to the SBA website? Have you joined the National Association of Women Business Owners? Or are you doing all the things that you need to do? In terms of the government, a lot of people have become millionaires with government contracts, but they had to get certified. They had to have their game together. They had to make sure they paid the IRS. They had to do all of those things that made them ready. So the government can help you if you're going to help yourself. But it really is a mindset of people, exactly what you're saying, Carl, where we somehow assume that we're not going to be able to do this. It's totally wrong. We have to teach our children that they can do it, and all the things that they have to do that, and they have to go through the hard steps. There is no secret to success. It is what those folks are doing, sitting there programming, getting up before 5 o'clock, staying up all night long. It's not going to just fall out of the sky. It really does a lot of work. And then you're going to have to be disappointed, and you're still going to fail, and you have to go back at it again. That's the way it is.
You know, it's funny, and you know this, the power of TV, right?
Mm-hmm.
What to me was one of my flippant statements kind of carried on, the whole NOAC demos thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it became the trending topic on Twitter for the next 2 days, and people kind of reached out to me about it. And really what it was that what I wanted these guys to understand is that whenever African-Americans do something in a space where we're not there, we have bi-directional criticisms, right? We have the people there saying, you shouldn't be here, and here's why. And the thing about technology, it's all about data. When you talk about pattern matching, they're basically saying that I'm just looking at data. Show me how many African-Americans have been successful entrepreneurs, and I'll invest in them. Well, we have to be successful entrepreneurs to change the data. So there's bias there, but they're falling back on data. And on our end, some of those same people were leaving, and people were like, why are you trying to start an internet company? Black people don't start internet companies, right, from our own people, right? So that's what I mean where it's bi-directional, where we have to recognize that when we go there, we have to be better, right? I told those guys, you're walking into Google. The janitors at Google are millionaires, right, because they got their options early enough. So for you to know that you're going there and say you don't have your idea to be ready, it's just ludicrous to me because you don't. Anyone you talk to says, hey, why are you here? You say it, they might say, hey, here's $10,000. You just don't know where your opportunities are going to go. So it kind of goes back to being an entrepreneur. If you're an entrepreneur, you realize that every day is an opportunity to grow your business wherever you are. You know, not to mention that you're one of the biggest internet companies in the world, but anywhere you are. And that's the thing is that we have to realize that it's not okay for us to be average. We have to be above average, and it's hard. I'm not saying it's easy, but we have to do it. That's how we break ceilings.
I just want to make a point about them, and I don't like the word a government, but I was going to refer to is community development and the governmental structure's opportunity and value. Going back to what our communities used to be, the bedrocks in our churches and nonprofits and all of that, they are not the leaders and pacemakers that they were 15 years ago. They just simply were not. You relied on that structure. And there is a vacuum in terms of leadership and voice and standards and all. And so I think it's an opportunity for where there is that, where there is not that, or the, I'll call it the public service structure, if you will, take the lead where we have a mind to do so. And that's what I was referring to, but I could not agree with you more. Whatever you make of yourself, it's up to you. With no barriers in place to prohibit or inhibit that.
I want to move very quickly to John Atkins, and then we're going to get questions out into the audience because Mr. Navarro has to leave. His father's not here. Sorry. Talk about your experiences getting your foot in the door and what kind of support you received.
Well, it's been difficult. I mean, I just want to piggyback on some of the things we as a people have a history, unlike white America, obviously. And certain mindsets from a slave standpoint are still embedded in our mind. And that's another obstacle that we have to deal with as far as I don't know. I remember talking to this lady who was at the post office. She was working at the post office. And she had her head all bandaged up. As you know, we sell the Dr. George Washington Carver Terminal, which relieves minor aches and pain. And I was asking her, you know, what happened to your hand? She's like, I got so much pain in my hand, and I tried everything. You know, the next option that I have is to get surgery. I said, well, look, have you ever heard of George Washington Carver rubbing oil? No, I never heard of it. I said, well, look, you can get a little bottle for $10 and just try before you have your surgery. Oh, I don't know about that, you know. So my point is, a lot of people still, even if they are aware that George Washington Carver, the great man that he was, he did all these things, they still are questioning his invention that are factual and are proven what he did in the past. So, and I'm sure everybody in the community at George Washington College Elementary School, George Washington College Middle School. And so everybody knows about this man. There's still a, you know, that slave mentality element in our people's head that won't have enough confidence in what this man has done. I mean, he's one of the greatest widely known scientists in this country. So everybody grows up, you know, doing a autobiographical special or a project on George Washington College. So I want to say that, you know, for us black entrepreneurs, we do have that, you know, we have that obstacle we have to deal with also.
We want to move very quickly into the second phase of this, and we'll come back to questions a little later on. But we want to open up the audience and get some questions that you guys may have for the panel. You can ask away. Stand up, state your name, and who you want to put your question to.
No, great question. So I think, so technology, so, you know, I answer a little differently. So technology entrepreneurship, I always say, is a little different than other types of entrepreneurship. So when someone says you're going to be an entrepreneur, they're like, hey, you need to write a business plan, you need to have projections and things of that nature. Technology is the one place that uniquely allows you to kind of leapfrog a lot of those things. And what I mean by that is, I use Facebook as an example. Like, Mark Zuckerberg didn't write a business plan. He just built a product, right, and the product got traction, et cetera. And technology is the one place where there are guys there who never wrote a business plan, who never did all those things, but built a product and gained audience. So the investor said, hey, this is viable. Let me invest in it. So in terms of the way the process worked in the accelerator, pretty much all accelerators are the same, is that they put the people in the environment to work on their idea. So the premise is you at least have an idea and you've kind of thought through it. And then you meet different mentors and people who are in the industry to give you their insights and give you the opportunity to bounce ideas off them while you're building that product. So it's a two-step process. I think the reason why the two guys went to that other accelerator is because that accelerator gave them more access to even more investors and more time to refine their product. And that accelerator actually gives you a little bit of money as well while you're doing it. So different ones do different things. But I also believe that if they hadn't gone through the New Me Accelerator, they wouldn't be prepared to get into that accelerator because there are a lot of African-Americans who apply to those programs, Silicon Valley, and don't get in. I also believe the challenge for us is a lot of those accelerators assume that you already understand the process and that you know what it takes to build your company, whether it's through technology skill, business skill, et cetera. I actually believe we need to create an opportunity where, and I think we need to start young as we can, to give people the exposure to that and understand what it means to build an application, what it means to build a technology product, to get them prepared for that. Because that's the other thing that those accelerators will do is they'll use data. They'll say, hey, we'd accept an African-American in the moment, but no one's come to us with a fleshed-out idea. No one's come to us who can build their own product. Right? Those are all the limitations we have because we're not going into technology fields. We're not picking up those skills. So we're creating those roadblocks, and they're using those same roadblocks to keep us out. So it's a weird, you know, it's a weird thing. So, you know, it's crazy. So the one guy, Arrington, those comments came out like about 3 weeks before the documentary, and there was this whole Arrington's a racist and things of that nature. And he may be, right? I've only met him once or twice. But he was being honest. I mean, he was literally laying out the situation. No one wants to hear the truth sometimes because it forces us to kind of look at ourselves and say, okay, what are we doing differently? The reality is we're not preparing ourselves to enter that market. So we're doing ourselves a disservice, and we're making it easier for them to keep us out. You know, when we were shut out of sports, we just stayed in the playground and got better and to the point where they couldn't shut us out, right? We got to do the same thing in this field. So.
And math and science and engineering.
Yeah.
We are not doing that, but people who are immigrating from Africa and the Caribbean and from Asia, of course,
right,
are doing that. And that's not happening in our really horrible inner city schools. But somebody's got to break through.
Any more questions?
The mentors raised a valid point. I said, well, he said he was Indian. He said that he had a representative go in for him that was white. So could there exist some African-Americans that are indeed the true founder but have a white person as their...
I'm sure it could exist. It's funny. I mean, one of the things, when Soledad interviewed me, she posed that to me, and I was like, he said what? But, you know, we shouldn't have to, right? So I understand where he's coming. But the other thing he said, it was funny, I thought you were going to say this, I thought he was true. We don't help each other. People latched onto the fact that, oh, he wants me, he's a white guy, crazy. No, we don't help each other. You know, let's be honest. I use Dunkin' Donuts as a great example. What Indian people do in Dunkin' Donuts is a group of them buy Dunkin' Donuts. They all pool their money together until they can raise enough money to bring someone else over, and they're all related. And then they get enough money, they buy their own Dunkin' Donuts, and then they keep it. And then they go and buy five houses in the street right next to each other, and they create a community. Now, you think about that. If Jamal brought a Dunkin' Donuts, the first time you start making money, he starts shutting you out because that's my money. You know, we have to change that mentality. You know, so we don't have to do that. Yeah, so there are biases. You're talking to a guy who was in technology for 20 years but was at BET and all these other African-American places. I'd go to conferences and be the only African-American technology executive, and they'd be like, oh, and they'd say BET and say, oh, because it was, okay, well, it's a black company, when they didn't know that for my first 10 years I worked at all majority white companies. So there, that perception is there, but the way we get past that is we just create better things, or we put a lot of extra effort in. We recognize, we face those on a daily basis. I think for us, to me, that doesn't push us further if we have to put someone in front of us to get, you know, we do it in different ways, but I think in that case we shouldn't do it. I just think we have enough skill and talent in our own world to do it. We just got to push ourselves and promote ourselves a little bit harder.
And you know more better than I do. There was that Joel Dreyfus article on TheRoot.com around the time this documentary aired, listing a number of African Americans who actually have been quite in the Valley. They just didn't think there was a historical perspective, but you know that community better than
me. Yeah, and you know, So I think two things we do, right? And I use Black America example, right? Anytime Black America comes on, everybody gets mad. You know what? We need to do this, we need to do that, and the other, and that lasts about a month, right? And then we go back to our way. And then the other thing people say is, well, they didn't talk about this, that, and the other, and they didn't talk about this person for 20 years. But quite honestly, are we talking about them? Are we pushing and promoting them? You know, I mean, that's what we have to. I mean, I guess I'm a little different, in fact, because I'm like, look, we can blame everybody else, but until we start taking some realistic level of ownership in the issue, it's not going to change. Because there's no incentive for them to change it for us. You know, is it that they don't want African-Americans in Silicon Valley? I don't necessarily believe that, because there are some. I did a screening at Google for the black Googlers. I saw 100 black people who work at Google. So it's not like they're not there, but they're not opening us because they don't need us to be there. The economy is there. It's growing. It's flourishing. So until we show them that, hey, and I did another interview where I said, you know, I'd rather them look at us the same way they look at China. They travel to China, but they won't travel to Chicago. Like that kind of stuff. So I could talk all day. But so there's two things I want to leave you guys. So I'm hoping you guys will have more conversations. So I brought you all copies of the documentary so that you can do it at your churches, your groups, et cetera. And then secondly, I'm an entrepreneur in everything I do. So I brought you guys all official No Whack Demos t-shirts. I'll get with Leslie. I have different sizes. Maybe we can take a 5-minute break, but I appreciate you guys having me. We're actually doing the same thing in Philly tomorrow. Hopefully, you know, we can use Martin Luther King weekend to kind of kick off this conversation, but thank you. I apologize for Amtrak.